Good evening, everybody.
Good evening.
We are picking up on 116b2, chapter 16. We're going to start with the second Mishnah of the Perek. Second Mishnah of the chapter. And we're still talking about the fire that breaks out on Shabbat within someone's domicile, within someone's home, and whether or not we can carry texts out into
the public domain.
Public domain. And into a domain at all that's got some question about whether it's public, which will come up in this conversation this evening. The background here before we begin that's necessary for this Mishnah. Already in the Masechet Brachot, the question becomes, where can I put my money? Very serious question of physical place within the ancient world. Where do you store your money in the ancient world if you don't have a bank? So I have coins. I have a certain amount of valuable coins, money. One way that in the ancient world I store my money is I bury it. I know exactly, or I hope to remember, exactly where I bury my money. And that's why in the Talmud and the Midrash we have stories of people digging up their funds, digging up money that was left by someone else.
That's a phrase in English. Got to dig up some money.
That's right. And you see, everybody's seen the fun pirate maps, right? Here's the buried treasure. Another place that I could keep my money, which was uniquely one of my holy little spaces and places that I knew exactly where it was all the time and no one else was going to come because of the laws about not sharing these items, is that I could put my money in my tefillin bag. Even though the tefillin are for what's called a holy purpose or higher purpose, gavoha, mala gavoha, I could use it if I was to appoint it as a place for my money. So a tefillin bag was considered this holy place that maybe I wouldn't put in my divrei chol, my secular kind of everyday need kind of items, except to say that if I appointed it as such beforehand, I could make this a place to actually hold money. It's one important concept to remember in the beginning here as we get into the next Mishnah. Secondly, when we talk about a container for scrolls, so we think in the realm of realia of that time, containers for scrolls were sometimes made of skin, sometimes made of more treated leather. Perhaps there were boxes. And we know that they were tied sometimes and stored sideways with wax seals. But what we're talking about in our Mishnah are not necessarily the old library kind of ways of storing things. We're talking about having a unique bag, probably box, or some type of skin that is a container for a scroll. That is like a pocket, as opposed to just an overarching like skin that you roll in, that may be a little longer and thus makes for some extra padding on the end of whatever tie pin, even that you can tie. You know, kind of like imagine a Tootsie Roll, right, where you twist it and you would tie it or something like this at the end for safekeeping. Okay, so those are important kind of things to remember, the physical reality that we're talking about in terms of this Mishnah. So let's jump in. I'm on 116b2. Matnitin. So we taught in the Mishnah. Matzilin tik ha-sefer im ha-sefer. We may save the container of a scroll together with the scroll. Pretty straightforward by way of saying, okay, you're in a fire. You know the scroll is within this container. The container itself is an item I see as distinct and apart from the scroll in my philosophy of action and my philosophy of textual understanding. Right? The container is not the scroll. V'tik ha-tefillin im ha-tefillin. And the container of tefillin together with the tefillin. So that is, when saving a scroll of the scriptures or a pair of tefillin from a fire on the Sabbath, their containers may be saved along with them. Now just to address the issue that comes up right away, right, reading the Mishnah. If I tell you that I'm allowed to read this scroll, then the scroll itself becomes something that's mutarli, that's permissible to me on Shabbat. Right? And therefore, when I actually go to save it, I'm not in essence thinking that this scroll is forbidden to me vis-a-vis saving it and or reading it. Because now I'm talking about a safer, a scroll that's permissible for me to read, right? Because otherwise I let them burn in the fire. So then I don't really have the issue that I'm going to have with tefillin. What's the issue with tefillin? Talking about a fire on Shabbat, tefillin are not allowed on Shabbat. Tefillin are in the category of what's called muktzeh. The rabbis create a fence for us around the Torah that says, I don't want you to touch anything that has either no purpose for you on Shabbat, that you can't use on Shabbat, and that serves no purpose on the Sabbath. We say that tefillin fall into such a category because we don't need that sign on our hands, or sign totafot ben enecha, or the sign between our eyes on Shabbat, because Shabbat in itself, ot hi leolam, is a sign between God and the Jewish people forever, and thusly I don't need my tefillin on my arm or my head. Neither on Shabbat nor on Yom Tov. If already the tefillin are themselves muktzeh, if the tefillin are muktzeh and I don't touch them on the Sabbath, then what? The teak, the bag of the tefillin too, are muktzeh. One category removed, by the way, because anything that is a bag for an item that itself is muktzeh of one sort, is in essence one level removed muktzeh, but it's still muktzeh. In other words, you might say to me, money as a tool, as an object of my desire and something I can use within business transaction, that's muktzeh. So, what if I only touch the wallet? I didn't touch the money. The wallet itself is muktzeh by way of the money that's in it, which is muktzeh. So this kind of level of muktzeh is also transferable to other things. So if on a tray there exists a coin, and it's the Sabbath, and I'm in my house, since the coin is on the tray, the tray itself becomes muktzeh. Even if I could have used that tray for serving food, because if in and of itself it's not necessarily something that I would see as, you know, made of silver and worth money. That's not really what I'm talking about. But it becomes muktzeh. Now, with certain laws of muktzeh, I can take a part of the tray and move it and kind of dump the coin off in a way that I would not normally handle a coin and then use the tray. So muktzeh becomes a very deeply focused upon subject matter of Masechet Shabbat, of Tractate Shabbat, within the Gemara. Because as the rabbis are creating the culture of the Sabbath, which is a culture that A, depends on your, quote-unquote, taking your feet out of business. Yim tashiv mi shabbat raglecha, says the prophet Isaiah. If you'll get your feet out of the marketplace for a minute, you'll be able to make Shabbat. And also, then we don't collect certain items like the sticks. You might have thought that was only for the fact that we were going to light a fire with them, but the sticks themselves are muktzah for the rabbis, so that you don't collect wood and build a fire. So anything that might lead me to do something that is a transgression of what's called a malacha, of a category of work that the rabbis defined as being definitely from either Torah or Derabbanan, or rabbinically prohibited entirely, muktzah is ordained as something you don't touch so that you don't transgress this. So what's radical about the Mishnah, or not so radical, but at least permissive about the Mishnah here, is that when I'm dealing with a fire, all right, so I can take the case along with the sefer. Well, I might have thought I should just take the sefer and not the case because the case itself is worth something and or it's just a container. So I say keep it together. But then, davka, I say about muktzah that I don't need and use on Shabbat, tefillin. I'm going to be able to take the tefillin out of my domicile along with the teak of the tefillin. And what do you think I might even have in the teak of the tefillin, in the bag of the tefillin?
Money.
I already set this up, right? Told you that it could be used for money. And that's where the Mishnah goes next.
What about jewelry?
Ve'af al-pi shi'esh betochan ma'ot. We don't call jewelry ma'ot in these days, so it's talking specifically about ma'ot, and therefore pshat, I would say ma'ot, and not tachshitin. Even though there's money in them, even though in addition to the scroll of the scripture or to fill in these containers, there's also money, which is muktzah on Shabbat, they may still be rescued. Ulaheichan matzilin otan. And already, I have to understand to where I can carry these things. Again, another essential component of the Sabbath observant culture coming in terms of legal constructs, that I have to know to where I can actually carry these things. The fact that I can carry it in and of itself is a question, not just an assumption. Can I really carry these things? And to where can I carry these things? So it says, L'heichan matilinotan, and where to can I carry them when I save them? L'mavoi she'eno mifulash, to a mavoi that is not open. A mavoi is a construct of space. It's a passageway that is a passageway into which people's courtyards open up in what we might call the letter chet of a buildup of homes. So imagine a chet of homes. Okay?
Three-sided.
It's a U. It's like this without these two tables. Okay? Hold off on those two tables on the end. It's basically this U. This one and this one, there. Let's say there are, you know, each of them are like brownstones, right? There are four brownstones on this table that's jutting out. Each of them has a little door and a little of its own courtyard, but then there are gates that open up to this passage. Okay? This passage is called the Mavoi. And imagine that down this line, so that these aren't sticking into the U, imagine that the walls are built here and there are little gates that just open up right here. So that's a Mavoi that is what? That is not open. Then Batera says, well, if I put walls here and it has nothing that kind of gates off out there, it's open. Let me make sure it's clear. Do I have my pad?
Yeah, that's the pad.
Okay.
I want to draw this out of here.
Thank you.
that you have.
And the Italian
old
homes have them, too.
There's your
head.
No, it's not a cul-de-sac.
Not exactly a cul-de-sac.
It's a courtyard.
No, no. It's a secret passageway.
Even if I do this, and I imagine this door, this door, this door, and this door, these are small courtyards.
Right.
They're vestibules.
It's private.
Right.
There's a door here.
That's not an alley.
Foyer.
And then here, there's a door. Door. Door here. And these are each homes. Okay?
Right.
This here, this space, that's called a mavoi.
We can each walk out from each of our, what did you call them, vestibules into the mall?
Yeah, right.
From the vestibule to the...
Right.
It's open because it's not closed right here.
Got it.
I think it's an alley.
I do too. It's an alley.
An alley.
What the rabbis call an alley is as follows.
The rabbis have an alley.
Here's a rabbinic alley. House 1, house 2, house 3, house 4, chatzer, 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 courtyard.
It has to be open on both sides?
That's an
alley. Is both ways. Okay.
The term avoy for the technical sense of Shabbat comes back to here.
Only one entrance.
Open when there's no fence and
on
gate.
One side.
There's, and it's open... According to several opinions, there are now several opinions as to what closes it and what doesn't. What might close this, possibility number one, is when one lechi, one cheek, is added right here. So this is one opinion. Another opinion, so that's opinion number one. Another opinion is that I need two lechis that don't even go across. So I'm going to put two and two. And another opinion, there are actually four opinions I can get out of this. Another one says I need a beam across so that people walking in actually go through a surat petach, an open door. And another opinion says, I don't need number two, as long as I extend this beam over to this fence and have just a board upon which to put it. And I extend the beam and have one lechi, then I can also call it closed.
But it's all about what makes a threshold. That's what's really about. It's about a threshold. When are you coming in and when are you going out? When are you changing your being
right
at home and when are you being in public? Is
it's really,
it's about?
It's, for them, it's about Surat HaPetach. The form way of a door, so that you feel like you're going into either a public or a private domain, which is called Rishut HaRabim versus Rishut HaYachid. So that's the whole construct here. This is an essential construct, again, throughout the whole Masechet of Shabbat. One of the central pieces that we're dealing with in this Mishnah that we've arrived to is, what can I touch, what can I not touch on the Sabbath? What's muktzah? What is a tertiary piece of muktzah? What do I do when I want to deal with something upon which Mukta sits, an item that I can't touch? Another is, in terms of our physical landscape, how do I define public and private places in which I carry or I don't carry? How do I share food? I have to make what's called an Eruv Tavshilin. Everybody in the ancient world who wanted to share food within this whole place, they could each cook something, bring it to spot X in this person's place, a blessing could be pronounced, and then everybody could eat each other's food. But the only way that I'm able to carry within this space is if I make it into a reshut hayachid by having, according to my local authority's ruling, a closed mavoi versus an open one. Because this is what's called the eruv, chatzerot, the Eruv of the courtyards. Eruv comes from the Shoresh, Le'arev, to combine together. Like Erev, like evening, is the combination of daytime moving into night. Questions?
Two questions. You mentioned wallet. What happened if my wallet has a kamea or tefilat aderech? And number two, in regards to a roof tafshilin in the courtyard, in the Mavoi here, but all of this is within the Tchum Shabbat anyhow.
There's an area that I can walk
called
Tchum Shabbat. That's a whole different principle. This is, Tchum Shabbat is the area of Sabbath travel that I'm allowed to make.
But
from
I'm
the center
to,
of my town.
I'm allowed to carry whatever.
No, you're not. You're not allowed to carry in that.
Even the tefillin or even the Torah?
You're not allowed to carry in that unless I give you permission and or you've made an Eruv Chatzerot or an Eruv Ha'ir, an Eruv of the city. Without the Eruv, I can't carry. So in New York City, if I don't believe that there's an Eruv, whether I'm in my area of Sabbath travel or not.
But they do every 2,000 amot or 200 amot, they put a table with the wine and a challah, and then they have another 200 amot.
Well,
so that's exactly the same.
What they're doing is they're setting up a situation where people are sharing food in Eruv Tavshilin, and then they need this Eruv of connecting the areas. Right? If within here I don't need this, which is one opinion in the Gemara, I'm in the Gemara times now, not everything is exactly solid. If I don't need this, Surat HaPetach, this kind of closed Mavoi, but with an Eruv Tavshilin, I can share food within this group of courtyards, right? I may be able to do so according to one or another opinion in the Gemara. Let's leave that aside. The principle here, though, is that I have to combine myself with my neighbors through this principle of Eruv. And I have to make this space closed or open to make it either a Rashut HaRabim versus a Rashut HaYachid, a public domain versus a private domain. And that's what we're relating to in our Mishnah. And there's a difference of opinion in our Mishnah about whether or not I can get there with my tikka tefillin, my tefillin bag, or not. And just to relate quickly to your wallet question, money and wallets act a little differently than this. And one's not to really touch neither a wallet nor money. But here, that's why it's radically designed to tell you, even if it has money in it, you're going to touch this. So let's keep with the Mishnah sense
here. But you've got to have Tfilat HaDerech, which is Divrei Kodesh.
No, remember, it's not. Psukim and individual Tfilot were things that you could let burn.
Even if 85 were a little bit more?
Well, but yours is not a scroll of Torah psukim. You're talking about a prayer. So, let's go back in here. So, I want to say that, first of all, the question is, if it's burning, can I take my bag of tefillin with my money? The answer of the Mishnah is,
Yeah, you can take your bag with tefillin and money. Then it says, L'heichan matzilin otan. And where can I take them to? L'mavoi she'eino mifulash. To a mavoi that is not open. Meaning what? It has some type of construct to close it. Which construct to close it? Various opinions as to what exactly closes it. I'm not sure from the Mishnah.
Which way?
Ben Batera Omer, and Ben Batera says the following. Ah, l'mifulash, even to an open one. Now it says, the note, the Gemara will define the terms unopen mavoi and open mavoi in the note below. I love that. Because that's acting just like Rashi acts. Sometimes he's going to say in his commentary that basically in the Gemara, that's going to be explained. So they're taking their cue in writing the notes for Art Scroll from the way Rashi wrote his notes in the margin, which is, in the Gemara, it'll define these words. The Gemara, though, doesn't go right into the question of what's an open mavoi or closed mavoi, or open or a closed passageway. It goes into, now, a discussion of Atana's understanding of another Mishnah based on now what we've learned in our Mishnah. And the subject matter that we're about to hear is now a whole different subject matter than what exactly we're talking about in our Mishnah. It's about the subject of the bringing of the Korban Pesach. It's about the subject matter of bringing the offering on Pesach, actually on the 14th. Because remember, in the afternoon of the 14th of Nisan, a person brings their Korban Pesach, their offering for Pesach. The individual is required to do that. We know we're going to put certain parts of the Korban Pesach on the Mizbeach, on the altar. We know also that we're going to roast part of the meat and that it has to be eaten on the 15th. Keeping that in mind, Atana says, oh, you just taught me about what I can save and bring out to this open or non-open mavoi. According to the opinion above, you could bring this teak with a tefillin in it and money in it. So you could bring out tefillin and money. You could bring out a sefer with the container. Interesting. I now think I understand a Mishnah. The rabbis taught in this other Mishnah. Tanu Rabbanan. I'm in the Gemara now. Arba Asar Shechalihiot B'Shabbat. Oh, by the way, I'm still on a Shabbos issue. And it's the 14th of Nisan. And I'm talking about bringing the Korban Pesach. Mafshitin et ha-Pesach ad he-chazeh. We flay the Pesach offering as far as the breast. Divrei Rabbi Yishmael b'noshel Rabbi Yochanan ben Baroka. These are the words of Rabbi Yishmael, the son of Rabbi Yochanan ben Baroka. V'chachamim omrim, but the sages say, mafshitin et kulo. So as set forth, look at note 18. We've got the Art Scroll, they do a very nice job of explaining what the issue is here. Every Jew is required to sacrifice a sheep or goat as a Pesach offering on the afternoon of the 14th of Nisan, the eve of the Pesach holiday, and to partake of its flesh after nightfall. Although personal sacrifices may not be offered on the Sabbath, the Pesach offering may be brought even when the 14th of Nisan falls on the Sabbath, even though this involves performing several ordinarily forbidden malachot. Even though there are certain major categories of work that the rabbis have defined as being asur, forbidden, on the day of Shabbat, I can indeed go ahead with this personal sacrifice. However, not everything involving the Pesach offering is permitted on the Sabbath. Thus, you have this Mishnah that was taught over in Masechet Pesachim. I can only flay it until here, according to Rabbi Yishmael, the son of Rabbi Yochanan ben Baroka, or I can flay the whole thing. Why do I need to flay the offering? I take out from within the carcass of the animal the parts that I need to put on the altar itself to burn up, and then I have the rest of that carcass prepared for me, in essence, to go on my spit and roast it. If you've ever seen the roasting of a sheep or a goat out in the open pit of, you know, kind of roasting, it's very interesting. You know, the entire skin is basically flayed. The internal organs from within the ribs and within the gut are all taken out and, you know, in some senses thrown to animal feed now. But back then, in this case, what you've done sacrificially, burned up on the altar, and then it's, you know, stretched across the spit. The preservation of meat, of carcasses that would be roasted later, I'm sure that there were a bunch of Jewish people arguing, like, and strategizing, like, how did they get to be the last one at 6 o'clock before sundown, which is 6:38? You know, like, you didn't want to be number one all the way up here, right? Because for hours, your goat or your sheep might lay on Shabbat. But wait a minute. That may be the issue. Because if I only have to flay it down to the chest and take out what I want to burn on the altar, maybe by keeping the hide on the animal at that point, I keep the animal a little bit fresher. So my roasting later on for eating purposes becomes safer to me. So is it an issue of health? Is it an issue of it doesn't matter when you do it because roasted meat and without all the blood in it generally was healthy enough and they knew how to preserve meat in a certain sense enough with the salting and everything else that went into the process because it is so many sacrifices, especially on a Pesach day, that didn't really matter at all. And I just want to be sure that I'm not doing certain forbidden acts, malacha, on Shabbat. So these are the questions in the background of this Mishnah. So as far as the breast is Rabbi Yishmael Benoshel Rabbi Yochanan Ben Baroka. And then the Chachamim come and say, no, I can do all of the flaying that I want to of the offering that I'm obligated to bring if it's on Shabbat. The Gemara asks the question, Bishlamo Rabbi Yishmael Benoshel Rabbi Yochanan Ben Baroka. Now, they translate it as, it's well. Basically, Bishlamo means, I can understand the reasoning and the position of Rabbi Yishmael, the son of Rabbi Yochanan ben Baroka, the ha'it avid le'tzorech kavoa, because the need of the Most High has already been fulfilled. In other words, since I've prepared the Korban Pesach, and I've flayed it down to the chazeh, to the chest, and I've taken out the innards, and I've burned them up on the Mizbeach, why should I go any further to actually flay the whole animal? If I know flaying the animal is a malacha, is a one of the categories of work or activities that I don't do on the Sabbath, because the rabbi set it up in such a way that that is one of the original 39 categories that I don't want to break on the Sabbath. So I understand Rabbi Yochanan's position. Whose position do I not understand? Chachamim. Why do Chachamim permit me to flay the entire animal? Hey, Lola Rabban on my Tama. Rather, for the rabbis, what's their reasoning? What could possibly be their reasoning that they said to me that I could flay the whole animal? Gemara answers as following: Amar Rabba Bar Bar Chana, Amar Rabbi Yochanan. Rabbi Bar Bar Chana said in the name of Rabbi Yochanan, De Amar Kra. And here's what the verse says: I'm informed by a verse, as we all are informed by verses for the kind of methodologies we learn. The verses of Torah tell us how to act, what to do, how to learn this out so that we can understand what it is that's permissible to us, what it's not. The verse states, Kol pa'al Hashem l'ma'anehu. The verse states, all has Hashem wrought for his honor, for his sake. The Gemara asks, V'hacha, my l'ma'anehu ikah. And here, what fulfillment of for his sake is there? How does flaying the entire animal bring glory to God? How do I understand, again, what's the question I'm functioning with? How do I understand Chachamim's position, that they're allowing the full flaying of the animal? Remember, I was Bishlamo with Rabbi Yochanan. I accept Rabbi Yochanan wants to have me cut it down to the breast. I'm required on the 14th to bring my sacrifice. I have to get it set to roast later on the 15th. But now to do the whole thing, how is that possibly giving any kind of level of holiness? Rav Yosef Amar Shelo Yasriach. Rav Yosef said, here's what it means, that the divine offering should not putrefy. So if it's going to affect the way that I'm able to preserve the meat in order to roast it in the right way, I'm going to do right by Kodesh Baruch Hu. I'm going to do right by God. Rav Amar, and Rav says, Shelo Yehu Kodesh Shemayim Mutalim Kenevela, and so that the divine holies should not lie around like worthless carrion. In other words, flay it, prepare it, have it ready, make it right to do the mitzvah that you need to do on the 15th. Ah, now I understand what that potential great, holy, higher purpose is of doing that malacha, of doing that transgression, potentially, that I might have thought the chachamim, the sages, were permitting by letting me flay the whole animal.
Shouldn't they be addressing the question of fire and cooking on Shabbos?
No, because for sacrifices for the public, of course we did it. And for the specialized purposes that the Mishnah lies out for us in terms of what is permissible and what is not permissible on the altar itself, on days like Shabbat, we accept as being quite functional. The inherent contradiction that we have work in the temple being done that we would otherwise forbid, right? That's a question. Let's let that hang as a philosophical question within our tradition.
I thought that would the fire already have been kindled?
Right. I mean, there's lots of ways to actually achieve the work that you want to do without actually having to break certain
rules. That's like cooking on Yom Kippur. Shabbos, you can't cook.
You can light the fire for Shabbos.
You can't cook on Shabbos.
Okay,
even with
the
right.
You can keep it warm. Maintain the warmth.
Right.
That's an inherent tension within tradition.
But this is all supposed to link back to the mission of carrying
correct.
The money.
Correct. Exactly.
We're
that's
not there yet, right?
We're not there
okay.
yet. How is this going to ultimately relate
right.
to carrying and carrying a teak and a bag and carrying that which is within the bag, which is permissible to you, that which is not permissible to you? So far, let's talk about that for a second since we brought it up. What is the potential parallel here, just by way of parallel to this animal? On Shabbat, what is permissible to me?
There are things that doche Shabbat, that a higher priority than Shabbat.
Right, there are things that are higher priority. So the fact that I deal with a sacrifice at all for Pesach is a high priority, and therefore, okay, so just the parallel of having higher priority than not breaking a Sabbath law could in and of itself be an interesting piece to just say there's a parallel here. Just as I break the Sabbath and carry things out to whatever kind of reshut, whatever kind of domain on the Sabbath because of the fire, so too do I have the ability to break Shabbat for the sacrifice that I'm going to offer vis-a-vis Pesach as a holiday.
There's a precedent for breaking the
Sabbath. Right. That's one particular parallel you can make.
But also that even if there are things that are put at a higher priority for Shabbat, you shouldn't do more than is necessary to serve the higher priority.
Right, and so that's why we had the limitations within the Mishnah about which scrolls I take and which scrolls I don't. That's why we're talking about the potential limitations of how far do I flay and how far do I not flay, because flaying like saving from a fire is one of the things that I wouldn't do on the Sabbath. So inherently, in and of itself, these are ways to parallel. Turns out that the parallels that they're talking about here don't necessarily fall along these philosophical lines. They're talking about, he's trying to push in and say, oh, I now think that I understand my Mishnah and the teaching over there in Pesachim, in Masechet Pesach, to be talking about this skin as a teak, as a bag, for that which is precious and permitted to me later, which is what? The meat that I want to make for roasting. So you'll see that come through.
Yeah, but there's a difference between the meat and the roasting that's compulsory by God's law and putting your money in the bag that's in the teak, that's your volitionary
unless
choice.
Unless you appointed this teak to carry your money to.
Well, but God didn't tell you you had to carry your money in the teak.
Right, but if you appointed it, then that makes
it
for this is exactly the conversation that the Rishonim have. Smart Jewish people within a Beit Midrash oftentimes parallel those discussions that the Rishonim have And when we get into those kinds of diukim, those kinds of distinctions, and we want to know about these distinctions, it's no mystery to me that we want to know, just like, thank God, our ancestors want to know. And that's exactly one of the questions that comes up by way of the Rishonim. You know, and so there's no solution to it.
No, no.
But there's a beautiful parlance here of saying, wait a minute, couldn't we see it that way? That we're not really, from Lechatzila, talking about a similar situation because I've created it as a person versus that this is an animal that I need and I've been assigned by God's law to make a sacrifice. It's true. It works that way.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Is there any consideration of the practicality of something burning? I mean, it just occurred to me that there's danger and that something is on fire, and if you have to sort through, you have to sort through the scrolls, or you have to sort through and take things out of here, take the money out, and take, you know, the things that are there. I mean, this seems to me as though this is like the immediacy. You can take the whole thing and you're really like saving
right.
your life by doing that. And, you know, maybe there's something...
Yeah, you're going to see that in the Gemara. It's going to come up. It's exactly one of the thoughts that's within the Gemara's...
Well, is there a parallel with, you know, the hygiene of the skin that keeps it from turning rancid or whatever? And
yeah. Yeah, there is. We're gonna see that too. Exactly. So we're anticipating some of the things that the Gemara is going to talk about within your questions. So, my benayhu, what's the practical difference between these two opinions? Ika benayhu demanach aptora didahava. The difference between them is in this regard to a case where the carcass is lying on a golden table. E nami yoma da asana, alternatively, or if you want to say that it's a day of the northern wind, in other words, a day that the northern wind's blowing, and that's a cold wind coming down, and it can be a preserving wind for a carcass, then I really kind of, you know, when it prevails, even unskinned meat will keep for some time without spoiling. Under these circumstances, Rav Yosef maintains that the rabbis will agree to Rabbi Yishmael that there is no need for the flame to be completed on the Sabbath. According to Rava, however, that the concern is that the offering should not be allowed to appear as worthless carry-on, the rabbis will still require that the flame be completed before nightfall. So what was the Ika Benayhu? It was Rava's understanding of Rabbi Yishmael's opinion. That what? Rava understands that Rabbi Yishmael would say, when there's a northern wind, oh, everybody would say, you shouldn't flay it all the way down. But on a day where there's no great northern wind that can preserve the meat, everybody would basically say, now I understand why the Chachamim went their way and Rabbi Yishmael still goes his. Sabbath laws versus preservation of the meat, and therefore it's about putrefaction. Gemara keeps going, though. Shelo yotzi et ha'emurin kodim hafshatata or. He derives from it that one should not remove the sacrificial parts from the Pesach offering. Oh, I'm sorry, let me go back. Gemara asks, bottom of column 116b3. Gemara asks, for Rabbi Yishmael ben Oshel Rabbi Yochanan ben Baroka, hai pa'al Hashem lema'anehu, my avidle, Rabbi Yishmael, the son of Rabbi Yochanan ben Baroka. So then, if he doesn't need the drush on the verse that I can do something for the glory of God, and therefore that verse that says I'm going to do something for the glory of God, and that means that verse teaches, like the Chachamim did, that I could slay the entire animal. One of the Gemara's ways of kind of giving an argument against somebody, or at least challenging them, is to say, well, if you don't have that drush on it, what do you do that verse? You know, like, okay, we learned it from a verse. This verse does teach that. The Chachamim hold it. What do you do with it? So tell me. So, what interpretation does he derive? The Gemara answers, Shelo yotzi et ha'emarin kodim hafshatara or. He derives from it the following. One should not remove the sacrificial parts from the Pesach offering before flaying the hide as far as the breast. In other words, you want to go down to a certain level. That's for the holy purpose. I'm giving you exactly where you flay it to. And then you take out the holy parts. What's the issue? How does it get explained further? Rashi basically explains, no, it didn't mean just that he gave you a certain place to flay it to. It means that they were expert enough in knowing where the innards were that they could have just punched a hole in the animal itself and removed all of the innards that needed to go to the altar. But that's not the way we do things. That you might have thought that you couldn't do the Hafshatah of the actual flame because it's one of the 39 major categories of work that we don't do on the Sabbath. The fact is that we could have made a hole, no flaying involved whatsoever, taken out the innards. I learned from the Pasuk that you learned and said the Chachamim learned, the sages learned, that I could flay the whole thing. That I could actually flay it down to the breath and then take the innards out, and I don't do it before. That's what he does with the verse. So he has a way of explaining the verse.
Because that's nicer than punching a hole.
That's nicer than punching a hole. My Tama, what indeed is the reason for this? Why can't an incision simply be made in the hide of the offering, thereby allowing the sacrificial parts to be drawn out without the need to flay the animal at all? Amar Rabbi Huna, Bereder of Hanatan, Rabbi Huna says, the son of Rav Natan said, Mishum Nimin, because of the strands of hair or wool that would otherwise get caught into the sacrificial parts as they're being drawn out of the body cavity. So they were careful not to make that puncture. And there's the reason not to make that puncture.
What does wool have to do with it?
Sheep.
You have a sheep or a goat?
Oh.
Gemara delves deeper. It says, Amar Rav Chista, Amar Rav Ukva. Rav Chista says the name of Mar Ukva. My ahadarule havaraya l'Rabbi Yishmael ben Shel Rabbi Yochanan ben Barocha. What did the colleagues of Rabbi Yishmael, the son of Rabbi Yochanan ben Barocha, answer to him? What argument did they advance in support of the view, of their view? The Gemara answers, Hachi kamarinan le, this is what they told him, Im matzilin tika sefer ima sefer. If we can save the container of the scroll together with the scroll, Lo nafshit et ha-pesach me'oro? Should we not be permitted to flay the Pesach offering of a tithe? Let's work out. What are they saying? If I can save the container of the scroll from the fire on the Sabbath and break the Sabbath, in other words, by bringing it out and carrying it, can't I flay the Pesach offering of a tithe? Somebody help work that out?
Not just the minimum. You can go a little bit beyond
go
that
the way.
In order to do the entire entity.
So it gets back to that issue that you were asking about. Can I just philosophically say, since I can go over there and do it,
I can do that.
Can I go over here and do it? I'm breaking a Sabbath law over here, or I'm going to break a Sabbath law over there.
This is good because we thought we were going to use the Pesach to learn about the tick. But in terms of we're learning about the tikkun for the other way around.
Well, if we're going to use the tik, right, exactly. We're going to use the tik now. He's going to use our Mishnah
against Rabbi Yishmael
to try to really flesh this out, no pun intended.
We don't have any skin in the game anymore.
That was a meaty remark. No.
Lock that metaphor.
Okay. Gemara rejects the reasoning. Mi dami, is the case of the Mishnah really similar to ours? Hatam tiltul. There, regarding the container, it's a question of moving mukta. Right? Mukta is a category of item that I make forbidden because it serves no particular purpose. And it leads me to engage in something that may really be, at its heart, a malacha, a forbidden activity. Tiltul is the word that the Gemara uses for carrying where I don't have an established Eruv, and I know I'm breaking the law of carry. Hacha, here, when it comes to the hafshatah, the flaying of the Korban Pesach, malacha. I'm talking about a particular category of malacha that the rabbis have established. 39 categories of established work that in and of themselves we call de'araita, versus even the Rabbanan. From the Torah, I do not engage in these works. So, The Gemara offers instead a different version of the rabbi's argument. Amar Rabbi Ashi. Rabbi Ashi says, "Betarte plige." Rabbi Yishmael and the rabbis disagree in regard to 2 points. Plige v'tiltu, they disagree concerning moving mukta. Uflige v'melacha, and they disagree when it comes to the essential category of work that is forbidden and that may be or may not be transgressed. V'hachik amrele, and this is what the rabbi said, the Rabbi Yishmael, the son of Rabbi Ben Baruches, to substantiate their point of view. In the mukta part of the dispute, about the things that we carry and don't touch because they themselves would lead to transgression. If we may save the container of the scroll together with the scroll, lo nitaltel or agav basar, should we not be permitted to move the hide on account of the meat? If you're going to go all the way over here, then shouldn't we go and take the hide in addition to the meat? In other words, making the hide a little bit like what? The teak, the bag. 117a, mi dami. Is the case of the Mishnah similar to ours? Hatam nasa basis l'dvar mutar. There, in regard to the scroll container, the container serves as a base to something that is permitted. That is, the scroll of the scripture. Hacha nasa basis l'dvar ha'asur. But here, in regard to moving the Pesach offering, the hide serves as a base to something that is forbidden to move, the meat of the offering. So now they're getting into the detail of arguing through the tiltul of mukta kind of outlook. The carrying of mukta. Even if you try to tell me that it sounds like the same thing, no, it's really not, because there I have the permitted scroll. Here I don't have any permission to really move the meat. The Gemara rephrases the analogy drawn by the Chachamim, the rabbis. Ela hachakam relay. Rather, this is what the rabbis say to really to promote their argument to Rabbi Yishmael, the son of Rabbi Yochanan ben Baruch. Im matilin tik shel sefer im sefer va'afal pishi yesh b'tocho ma'ot. If we may save the container of a scroll together with the scroll, even though there's money in it. And money, we know, is forbidden. And now I have my parallel. Lo nitaltel or agav basar. Should we not be permitted to move the hide on account of the meat? The Gemara rejects that reasoning too. Mi dame. Does it really resemble our case? Ha tam nasa basis l'davar ha'asor l'davar ha'mutar. There, the scroll container serves as a base both to something that is forbidden, the money, and to something that's permitted, the scroll. Ha-chakulo nasa basis l'davar ha-asur. Here, if you're going to tell me that the skin serves as a bag or a case, it doesn't serve as a bag or a case to something that's permitted and something that's forbidden. It only serves something that is what? Forbidden to me on the Sabbath. That meat is forbidden to me. Now,
what's forbidden about the meat? To move the meat, don't you have to move the meat to put it on the altar?
Well, the meat's not going to go on the altar. I have to roast it on the 50th.
Yeah, but you got to move it to do that. So
basically, I think the piece here in that terms, like, oh, wouldn't it be that the person themselves, I think the Kohen can hang it up on golden hooks, as the tradition says they did. They had all these hooks for all these different individual offerings for these carcasses, and I guess people would know exactly which one was theirs, but it's not the same. It is forbidden to you. It is forbidden me. So we have to see that in the construct here of how they're functioning within the Beit HaMikdash.
Sorry, I don't follow. Are they saying that it's okay to move the container even if it doesn't have money in it?
Well, first of all, they're saying it's okay to move the container of the scroll even if the scroll is there alone without money. So I saved that from a fire.
Right.
To tefillin, even if it has money. So yes, I can move tefillin, and yes, I can move tefillin even if the bag has money.
So to just the important item, the power of the positive...
Carry more weight.
Carry, right.
If I have a scroll that's permitted to me,
the
but I have money in the container for the scroll, because now I'm learning over from the example of the tefillin bag that has money in it to the example of the container that also might have money in it. So then I can move it, yes.
And does it matter if you put the money in that storage place in case of a fire that you then can take it with you, if your intention of storing it there is for the purpose of being able to save it on Shabbat, does that matter?
You know, I would imagine that since you know where your money is and you've designated such a bag to have your money, in case of an emergency, right, the person's going to grab his or her tefillin, and thusly it's a great place for your money.
And a way out.
You know what I mean? Like, so
they put the tefillin with the money.
I think for any kind of emergency, that's probably one of the reasons why they make that a place for money.
It depends on Jewish
people. But that's okay.
That's actually, yeah, that's the Gemara in Brachot that says, okay, I know that people are going to do this. And that's why we're dealing with this reality of the fact that during a fire, I'm going to ask the question, like, what if I use that place to store my money? Can I save it? I mean, to fill in, I could see.
Yeah.
Money? But yeah, money.
The money doesn't happen to be there. Just put it at the outside.
Yeah, I mean, there's an argument by the Rishonim whether or not this is a setup. This is a setup for a case that actually the person didn't go through saying that this is really my place for money, and I did put my money there, and now it's there, and what do I do if I hadn't really made this a designated spot for my money? They like to do that exercise, but bottom line is shot. Simple sense. You could say it.
Just to the point of the meat, the golden hooks. So you can see the models from Egypt, which precede the Talmud, of course, by thousands of years, and you see the models for the afterlife with the meat on the hooks. So it's the same image.
Yeah.
Or else you're going to put your meat.
I could have made a little, remember we saw the library for the cuneiform tablets? I could have put it, horizontal. He doesn't like
you
that.
You want the blood to come down. Usually they take paragraph from the Torah, and here they took and build up an issue. Here they took it from Mishle. So, I mean...
Mishle?
From Proverbs.
Thank you.
So that's negative. So there is nothing in the Torah to justify the higher kavod. I mean,
it's a good question on a systemic basis. When do I have verses from Torah versus when do I have verses from prophets versus writings from which I can learn tradition or applied law? We can't say that only Torah is
the only place.
The
whole concept is that the Gemara need to base on the Torah rather than other books.
No, so my point is that we'll find many places where there are verses that are proof texts that come also from other places. So
the note seems to suggest that the Proverbs is not being used as proof text, but just to illustrate the logic, that it's deduced by logic.
Yeah, so right now what we're doing, though, I was going to make mention that, remember, we use the word drush. It says, what do you do with this? What drush do you make? So we're not talking about full-out legal parlance of law. But we are learning it from it, and we have what's called an asmachta. So a lot of times, verses that are not Torah verses become the verses that teach us the logic and the explanation of a tradition that we might learn very very legally, right, and codifically, without even making the verse the substantiated source for the law. So that's called an asmachta, or it is a verse that in essence is a place where we drush the law from, and sometimes it leads to a legal decision. In this case, we're going to see that it really is not substantiated. It doesn't substantiate any law. So thusly, we could say that we're in the middle of a discussion about drush. But to the larger question of are there verses outside of Torah that are used for the production of law, the answer is yes. We don't just only depend on Torah verses. We can bring a few examples down the line of some of those. But here, we also remember have one Mishnah being put up to learn towards another Mishnah to see whether or not we can actually keep our systemic reasoning kasher, kosher, pure. Does it work systemically? One to the other Mishnah. can I learn from this Mishnah mm-hmm. over here to this other Mishnah?
Now, when they quoted that proverb and it said all, right, it was coal, and I was thinking of the Haggadah where it says, you know, when I learned when it said all the days of our life instead of just the days, it means the life to come and everything, I thought that maybe they were going to emphasize the coal again, meaning not just a portion of the carcass, but the entire thing by saying,
right, nice midrashic parallel.
But nobody thought of that.
You did.
We are
in 1574.
I just put it in.
Keep a running commentary in the margin, Bob.
Shatter than the shot, whatever that is.
Just following up on what Ron said, do you think that the use of a source from the Proverbs, which is Ksuvim, in the context of having learned in the Mishnah that, you know, we don't like these Ksuvim, or maybe we do, and
we don't study them,
and especially as you pointed out, I guess, that I didn't know, that they start out, it looks like it's really a good basis for learning something, and then at the end they say, well, we don't learn anything from this, or at least we're not going to learn anything from this here. Are they playing with us from a literary point
of
view?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a very, very conscious decision.
Mm.
I think the question of whether or not we actually learn from Ketuvim any kind of drashot and any kind of halachot is a question. You know, it's a question throughout the whole Gemara. It's a question of the canon itself and what we learn from. There are investigations of this question by way of Talmud scholars as to how we actually are using these verses, whether they are not asmachta every time, and then show Talmudic logic so that you can get to apodictic law, the prescribed kind of codific law, versus a kind of drush on an actual verse from which I learn three things. You know, three verses, al tevashel gedibu chalav imo, don't cook a kid in its mother's milk. I can learn three things by the fact that it's repeated three times in Torah. You shall not mix milk and meat, you shall not cook milk with meat, and you shall not derive any benefit, business-wise or otherwise, from, you know, non-kosher food. Those are the three kosher laws, for instance, come from having three mentions of such a verse that within a halachic midrash. But we can look a little bit deeper into the use of sources, and especially keep it in mind as the chapter goes on. What sources are being engaged? I'd like to focus back in on their reasoning, and that is, the Gemara is attempting to rephrase the analogy time and again here. Ela hachi kamrei lei. Rather, this is what the rabbi said to Rabbi Yishmael to espouse their opinion. Mevi'im tik sheyesh betocho ma'ot me'alma lahatzil bo sefer Torah. If we may bring a container containing only money from elsewhere in the house to save in it a Torah scroll, meaning the Torah scroll is lying over there unencased, we bring the receptacle containing only money over to the scroll to place it inside the receptacle and carry it out to safety. Lo netaltel or aga basar, should we not be permitted to move the hide on account of the meat? If I can bring this container that has a forbidden item within it to save that permissible scroll, whether I can read it today or not, now let's just fill it out. I won't wait till the end. Which scroll are we talking about?
Sefer Torah.
So it sounds like we're talking about a Sefer Torah.
Not the tefillin.
But if I'm talking about tefillin, and those are objects that are, in essence, scrolls, right?
Yeah,
and the objects themselves are forbidden to me. I could be talking about the scroll that I'm forbidden to read, which is, in and of itself, what? Ketuvim. And Nevi'im. Prophets and writings.
With the money, even.
And Targum.
And Targum, depending on what I really come down with Targum. Translation. So I just to put it all in context, it's a little bit fuzzier. Here it said Torah scroll, lahatzil bo sefer Torah. Now they, it's the first time that the scroll in question is actually called what?
Sefer Torah.
Sefer Torah. We didn't have that before. What do we have in the Mishnah? Tik ha-sefer im ha-sefer. So, tik im ha-sefer. Rashi said, "V'af ha-pishi yesh b'tocho ma'ot u'mishum kavod ha-sefer, shehu tzorech gavoa, avdinan behedya, hatzalat ma'ot shehen tzorech hedyo." So he says that even though I have these common things like monies, the holiness of the sefer is something that allows me to actually do the work. Rashi didn't even tell me that it was what? An actual and only Sefer Torah. Mm-hmm. Now, in the course of the argumentation, I see that it moves to Sefer Torah, just to keep in mind the kind of way that people are trying to parallel this situation. So the Sefer Torah is mutarli, right? It's permissible to me. It's permissible to me to read even on that Shabbat, which would make it different than the roast, the potential roasted meat, the meat that's even coming, but it's sacrificially, it is permissible to me to do this on the Sabbath because I have to get my Korban Pesach ready for the holiday of Passover coming. So therefore, I'm trying to parallel it again. But it says, we should we not permit to move the hide on account of the meat? Because that meat, I need it for my sacrifice, just like I need the Sefer Torah to keep its holiness, to actually save it because I know I have to, and I use it, and I can read it even on Shabbat. Vehi gufa menalan. But this very point, that it's permitted to bring a container containing money over to the scroll. Now they're going to say, from where do we know it? If you'll say that since where there's money in the container, together with the scroll, the Mishnah permits a person to move the container and he need not first throw out the money. In other words, to the issue that Bobby, you brought up, what if I have a container over there? And I know that I got to get the Sefer Torah out of the house. And that container is where I keep my money. Can I bring it over here and save the Sefer Torah with the money in it? The answer is yes. Right? What's that?
No, I have another level of concern, though. Because basically, if you use the Torah to get the money, the Torah then become a tool. And is that a problem?
Well, no, so right, so back to if you use the teak, let's go back to what you did bring up before for a second to now build your question further. What you did bring up before and what I recall you bringing is that the teak has tefillin. If I used it, right, as the place where
you
I
deliberately
put
money
my money there because I want to save it.
Right.
Here, if I deliberately put my money in the container, and I know that I'm going to use it to save the scroll, right? The dilemma I have with the scenarios, if you will, is that planning for an emergency situation, in terms of where I put my different items, the rabbis for sure wanted me to save my money. They actually have a principle called Torahi. Hasal mamonam shel Yisrael. The Torah is merciful with the money of the Jewish people. Now you want to argue of something here in the Beit Knesset, right? You don't want to go there. That's fine.
But I'm meaning the Torah by using an object to get the money.
So in a certain sense, we're not demeaning Torah in either case because the rabbis realize the importance of what this money is for you in your life. So I think what's going on is not necessarily like this is coming to give you the excuse to be able to carry money. I think it's really about the inherent value that it's placing on that tool of life.
Right, it's life. Okay. But you can use the Torah then to protect money.
I think they're not really using it either way. I think they're really setting it up so that the important vessels, the important tools in your life can be saved at a time when you need to save them. I don't know if it's about the...
Yeah.
I don't know if it's about using one or the other.
You couldn't save the money. The Torah is being used as a device to save the money. And let's call it what it is.
Or else it's just a convenient way of keeping two important things in the same place.
Yeah.
So you don't have to run all over the place and gather this.
Yeah.
I mean, even now the city tells you have a so-called go bag. And the reason is grab one thing and leave.
I'm just saying that if
that's
you use the Torah as a tool,
yeah.
I thought the Torah was like the holiest thing that like...
Right. So you're actually, in this case, your point is shot. The Torah is the only thing allowing you to take that container with the money.
It's a tool. Out
into the Reshut HaRabim.
It sounds like you're really trying to say that the rule is suspicious. That's what it sounds like.
No, it's beyond that. That's what I realized, because you're using the Torah as a tool.
So here's the thing.
Well, then the Torah becomes an object that's a...
No. So let's look at it differently. The Torah becomes that which infuses the holiness, enough holiness, into the whole container and pile of money you have there to say that it's that important. And because the rabbis knew that, by the way, such a container or a bag for tefillin, as I said in Masechet Brachot, we're not inside there. I didn't bring the other sugi because I didn't want to get involved in the whole sugi there. But in a certain way, what they're saying is, you can really say this is my spot because there's inherent kedusha in all that. They wouldn't allow money in those bags or containers if there wasn't some sense that we really needed to guard and protect this. And what they're doing is they're providing a way on the Sabbath, in a legal fiction kind of way. It's true. But not completely making the Torah just a tool to transport it. Yeah. In some way, though, what it does is it marries up this holy Torah to that which we understand is important, but otherwise would not touch on the Sabbath. And then that allows me to carry the whole thing out.
To me, it's incredibly shocking.
No, it is.
They would save the money anyhow, so they want them to save the Torah too. Otherwise, they would take the money.
That's
what will happen.
All right.
Let me
push on.
Okay.
Is that case similar to the Mishnah's? In other words, where if you're going to say where there's money in the container together with the scroll, the Mishnah permits the person to move the container, and he need not first throw out the money, right? Hatam adahachi v'hachi nafla deleka. There, in the Mishnah's case, if we obligate him first to throw out the money, there's a danger that what? In the meantime, the fire is going to catch the scroll. And it's going to burn up the scroll. Hacha, adahacha v'hacha lishdinan. Here, adahacha, in the meantime, v'hachi lishdinan. Let him throw out the money. In other words, what? As he is running with the container, let him throw out the money. Therefore, there's no basis for the assumption that it's permissible to carry a container with money in it over to the scroll. By way of the fact that I have a container that already has money in it, and I've made it the place where I keep my money and the scrolls in it, I can go grab it. But over here, where I really have the situation, where you've got a container over here, a person might have enough time to actually throw out the money. And so arguing about this situation where you're going to carry a container over here in order to get the scroll... And this kind of gets back into what you are presenting as one of the great challenges to the notion here that you're going to, quote-unquote, be able to use that Torah scroll to save this money that you've got sitting over here in a container on this side of the room that I'm going to bring over to save it. So what is at the core? The core is it goes back to an original kind of suggestion that Marbar of Ashi says the following. Turn to 117a2. Kida Aminan Me'ikara. After all, it is as we said originally, that what? Rabbi Yochanan ben Baroka and the rabbis disagree only in regard to one point, whether it's permissible to what? Flay the Pesach?
The whole way down. Or just partially.
It's really, you're trying to learn one thing to the next with our Mishnah, it can't match up. And this is what they're disagreeing about. And udekashi alach Hacha tiltu v'hacha malacha. And as for your difficulty that here, in regard to the scroll container, it is a question of moving muksa, which is forbidden only rabbinically, whereas here, in regard to the Pesach offering, it is a question of performing a biblical malacha, the answer is kagon delo kabai le'laor. Here we are discussing a case in which the person does not need the hide. Meaning what? The whole intent here is to flay the animal to get to the actual Pesach offering. But Abai and Rava have both said, Mo de Rabbi Shimon bifstik reisha velo yamut. Rabbi Shimon concedes that one is liable in the case of an inevitable consequence. And here's the Gemara principle. Seek reisha velo yamut. If I cut off a chicken's head, are you telling me it's not going to die? So, let's say that I say that I'm going to check this animal, right? And then I'm going to say, but I don't really intend on having the chicken die, and I'm not going to use it as a chicken feed. Can I really say that? Is my intention, my philosophy of action, allows me to say I'm just going to cut off the chicken's head without the chicken actually dying? So what is inevitable? If I flay the whole animal, what do I get? Meat inside and the whole hide. So don't tell me that it's I flayed it just to get the meat inside. I got both the hide and the meat. And that's parallel to the fact that I have a teak, a bag with money, and
a Torah
scroll. Don't tell me it's just for the Torah scroll itself. I actually have both items. Ah.
What did they do with the hide?
The hide could be used for all sorts of things.
So when they did the sacrifice, or when they roasted this, they used the hide for something too, so that's part of it.
No, but here now it's going to tell you that they didn't, because when they did this kind of flaying, what happened? The shakilei bivarzei. Ah, we're dealing with a case when he actually cuts the hide into strips. And therefore, what?
Usable.
I don't have a full hide to use. Now, that's kind of where it ends up. We have a fundamental disagreement between Rabbi Yishmael and the Chachamim. He says only to the breast flay it. The Chachamim say, oh, flay it the whole way. Right? All kinds of suggestions. If I can take out the bag with the money in it and the Torah scroll, then shouldn't I be able to what? Flay it the whole way. Because I can take what I need, which is the meat for roasting. In addition, I should be able to break the Sabbath law regarding the flaying of the animal. Because if I can do that on Shabbat over there, why not here? What's the fundamental question that differentiates the two situations? One is an emergency of a fire. The other is the ordained order of sacrificial steps that I need to make in order to prepare my meat for roasting. What's that? From Torah, but despite that, what I'm a little surprised about is that there's not the fundamental assertion that over here it seems like there's a little bit of an emergency, and it's a case of, you know, not all the way pikuach nefesh ala life and times, but it is in essence the saving of that which is holiest to us in an emergency situation. And over here, we don't have such an element of emergency situation going on. We have no element of fire. We have only, though, to say, okay, what is the parallel? Parallel being If I have religious values that come and, in essence, have to be performed on a Sabbath, back to, I think, Dan, you said this at the beginning, fundamental religious values of needing to keep Pesach or needing to keep Torah preserved in its scroll form so that I have it within my precincts. Right? I don't just remember it orally. I can save these scrolls. Even when there's muktzah in it. And even though I have this hide that I've got to deal with, then the religious values, the precepts that I have to ultimately keep alive and going well, I might have to do that even if they break fundamental Sabbath laws. That could very well be what the whole conversation ultimately leads us to, because there's not really a parallel in the final form except to say, when I have the teak, the bag, and that which is permissible to me, I might be able to, and we don't have a fundamental resolution, I might be able to parallel that to this outer covering of the animal and the inner what I need so that I've got this case. Except that the very last point of the Gemara is, what? That you've cut up the hide. And that it's not really exactly going to turn out to be an exact parallel, because it's now cut into strips, and I don't have then the same issue of flaying without a difference, without a shinui. So the discussion to try to rationalize one way of behavior on a Sabbath in regards to Pesach offerings vis-a-vis the behavior, the law that I ordain in an emergency situation when a fire breaks out in my own personal dwelling, can't really lead me to make an absolute determination, except to explore what the difference really is between Rabbi Yishmael and the Chachamim. Anybody understand it differently now that we've gone through it? Please.
So what is the halacha?
According to the difference of opinion, when it's cut in strips, one thinks it's playing the whole way and one thinks that you ought not.
So
that's where we are here.
But the strips mean that you don't have a secondary gain from it. You are doing what is the obligation, and you are not going any further than that. Which I think is an important point that they ended up with.
Mm-hmm.
Even though you take the hide off, it's not to utilize the hide. The fact that they use this form of sacrifice, though, doesn't that really emphasize the centrality of the Pesach, you know, for us, centrality in the Torah, and the centrality, the important thing not to forget for the Jewish people? They take this as an example. You could take something else.
Yeah.
And it would not be as strong, an argument to make.
Right. I mean, I definitely think that every time the Gemara editors make a decision as to what to include, they are absolutely teaching us about what is important and what is really essential to remember.
Following with that,
so could that be the case? So there is the holy, there is the Torah, but money is very essential to life, so they figured out this way where you could put it in your teak. Whereas, so that has more value in a way than a skin.
Yeah, I mean,
so are they differentiating, priority?
Nice. So I do think that there's an undercurrent of the discussion of how important money is and how it's essential that it has to be saved, and one should know where it is and how to save it.
Yeah.
But it's not the hide, we're talking about the meat. That is the benefit to the person who's bringing the sacrifice.
Right, so with the sacrifice.
So the meat is the benefit to the person, and the money is the benefit to the person.
Yeah, but so is the Torah in that case.
Yes. Well, Well, that, I think that's the difference.
Yeah, exactly. That is the difference.
But the sacrifice of men did it, right?
Yeah.
Philosophical. It's a really strange thing. The money is not in nature. It's value. It's completely in nature.
What was?
The Pesach.
Yeah.
Was used to save lives. I mean, maybe the rabbis kind of knew that that might be a hard decision for somebody to save their life, to leave their money, to leave their,
mm-hmm.
I mean, what they would consider the substance. I mean, that's probably.
Right. I mean, it definitely was very difficult to think about leaving that behind.
But it's different. If, let's say you have the bag and it's got the scroll in it and the money in it. Take that out. Fine. Okay. But to have a bag that has money in it, that's a bag meant for a container, for a scroll, and to go to another part of the burning plate to then put in the scroll, where you could have just read and got the scroll, that's, you're using the scroll as a, that's where I'm stuck. Because why doesn't Bennett say in the Torah, value money, save the money, it's okay to break Shabbat to get to take the money?
Because the rabbis are thinking about our lives on a very practical level, knowing that money, they've made mukta, or to handle money is really asur, it's forbidden. And they, and here they find a way to...
But there's so many things that are prohibited.
Yeah, but here they find a way to bring into the world the real reality of our property into a space that we might otherwise think not. So I think that it's actually, you know, in that sense, radical legislation within the Shabbat framework, and they're trying to understand whether or not there's any parallel in the world of sacrifices and the way that Shabbat was broken during the time that the Beit HaMikdash did stand. Remember that they did have themselves, they were removed a little bit from this culture, especially the Amoraim, the later Gemara rabbis, who were trying to look towards the Beit HaMikdash, and thinking about like what really let them permit this and how did they do it within the context of their reality. Is it like the way we allow people to take out a bag with money and their tefillin? And so, in essence, the last thing I'll say for the evening is they're really connecting back to a history, wondering if they were historically connected to Shabbat in the same way that people functioned when they brought their sacrifices to the Beit HaMikdash on the Sabbath day.
But there's also the point that the 14th coming on the Shabbat happens irregularly, just like a fire happens irregularly. And so the, how can I say it, the freedom, the flexibility, the tolerance for something to be out of the norm on an irregularity is important. This is not something that's happening every year, nor is there a fire happening
nice.
Every year. So I think we this is almost as happening every Shabbat.
Yeah,
it's sort of the fire.